I'm Carrie Fountain, and this is Just to Say, where we talk to poets about the poems they make and the poems they love.
I mean, it's a matter of life and death. It's absolutely urgent to say, we are here together, and with these words, we want to make change. I'm Jane Miller, and this is May You Always Be the Darling of Fortune. March 10th, and the snow flees like eloping brides into rain. The imperceptible change begins out of an old rage and glistens, chased with its new craving, spring. May your desire always overcome your need, your story that you have to tell, enchanting, mutable, may it fill the world you believe, a sunny view, flowers lunging from the quilt, the sill, the chair, all things fill with you and empty and fill. And hurry, because now that I tire of my studied abandon, counting the days, I'm sad. Yet I trust your absence in all things wholly evident, the rain in the white basin, and I vigilant.
Thank you for reading that poem beautifully. I heard you read this poem at your reading at Malvern Books, which was such a wonderful reading. And you said of this poem that it was a poem that you wrote for your students.
Yes.
So could you say a little bit more about where this poem came from?
Sure. Well, my first job was at Goddard College in Vermont. And it was at that time that I was very frightened of teaching. I was new at it, and I began to teach a class early in the morning called Light. And I had such a wonderful experience that I wrote this poem at that time for my students. And from time to time as a teacher, I have had that same feeling of being greatly inspired and comforted by students. And since I felt that this semester, I wanted to present this poem at the reading for the students I'm working with now.
And those students are at the Michener Center.
Yes, they are.
I feel like it has a quality that not all poems that deal with that teacher-student relationship have, which it's a generous poem.
Well, thank you. It's a
almost
love
like
poem.
A prayer. It is a love poem.
It's a love
yes.
poem.
Yeah. So, can you say more about that?
Well, I think of myself as a love poet, although I would hope it's clear that I have other concerns as well, political concerns and spiritual concerns, aesthetic concerns. But I try to approach all of those concepts from the point of view of tenderness and warmth. So how can I approach a subject that is for a philosopher or for a politician or for a spiritual leader with my lack of training? But just as a layperson, it seems to me one can approach a subject with a kind of compassion and empathy for all of its various points of view. And that seems to me a loving posture, although I can't say that I have such a great track record in my personal life with love. I aspire to give that feeling and to approach any subject in that way, in the hopes that at least even if I fail, I will have been calm toward the other. And so my students, who often gave me headaches, you know, when all was said and done, that during that first year of teaching, it was just a tremendous gift to have been there.
And you are, aside from teaching this semester at the Michener Center, you are a teacher. That's what you do for a living.
I am, although now I am ceasing that honorable game.
I didn't realize
in a
that.
Week or so, yes. It's very exciting to think about being free again after teaching for so many decades.
That's amazing.
Yes, I have, I think, one or two more classes. At some point, maybe I would come back in to teach, but I need to think of myself as free right now.
It's so funny because I was going to ask you to speak a little bit about teaching and your own writing and how those two things coexist.
as a writer yourself and to anybody who's listening who is engaged on that level with material, that includes almost everybody, it's very difficult to do more than one thing. Some people can, and great for them. It's very hard for me to focus like that. I have to get pretty far from teaching, even if it's just from day to night. That can be a great distance sometimes, but sometimes I have to wait years to get back to my work. Mm-hmm. If I do write when I'm also engaged with other people's writing, it's usually practice and not very deep for me, because I have to get really in touch with my emotions. I think that's the source of my work. And that takes a long, quiet, terrifying journey,
mm-hmm.
which I can't really do in the company of others.
Right, something that you do alone.
Yeah.
And over a long open period of time. What do you think, or what are your plans, artistic plans, looking forward?
I don't really know. I hack away. Mm-hmm. It's always a new page and always a blank page, just as I'm sure it is for you and others. I'm excited that I have no excuse now. And I don't really aspire to a lot of material. I mean, I think if I could write something, one good piece, I would be very happy.
Yes.
And something different. For me, writing another book would mean writing it completely differently from anything else I've done. I mean, I think everything has the mark or the voice of, the original voice that you had when you started out. For me now, it's been many decades. But even a slight shift would make a big difference to me. And that requires, of course, a change in consciousness. Otherwise, it just seems superficial. Okay, I'll write sideways and not up and down, or I'll write short poems because I write long poems. I think that's kind of part of the game of writing. But I mean, in order to have a homeopathic shift, in other words, a very small, minuscule change that would make for different perceptions, that would take a kind of change in consciousness that I hope comes about by getting quiet.
Do you feel like that is something that you have only imagined, or do you feel like you have in your past as an artist?
I've aspired to it. I think it's been, a broken road, but I aspire to it. Yeah, sure. I've probably thrown out a book between each of my books because I think I was still writing the same book. Pretty good poems. I think if you're trained as we are, then eventually you can kind of write pretty good poems, some better than others. But I'm not interested in sharing those because it seems like I've already said such and such. So I don't know if that's an illusion, but I feel different enough sometimes that I can begin anew.
So you've published, this is, you're up into your, but you said more than 12
probably,
collections
yeah.
of poems. And you're saying sometimes I hear what you're saying so deeply about continuing to write the same book and not, how you move on from whatever material or consciousness, as you say, that you have previously occupied. You must write a lot then.
Actually, in bursts. Sometimes years go by and I don't write anything. And then I can really get into a state mm-hmm. where I'm very, very active.
When you were starting out writing and the first years of, not writing came to you, or the first extended period of sort of not being, for whatever reason, not accessing that, were you scared that it would never return, or that you would never return?
No, I was scared it would return.
Oh.
It's always a deep dive. It's for me, it's very scary and threatening in the sense that I have to go into material that I don't understand or that overwhelms me. I always think of myself as an artist. I'm not saying a good artist. I'm saying I think of myself as an artist. Mm. And so whether I'm writing or not, I am being a poet in the world, trying to think of language as my parallel life to the life that I live with others.
Mm-hmm.
And I find myself always aware of that role, that responsibility to language. Mm-hmm. And then eventually I hope I will write something down and be able to handle it.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's really fascinating to think of it that way, as being, you know, that it comes to you.
I think it meets me halfway. I'm a Taurus, so I'm very practical, but also very stubborn. And so I wait. And then, I do think that language has a life of its own. It's come down to us, to you and to me, through centuries of use and abuse and confusion. And it's alive. And it's up to us to keep that going.
One of the things that I kept going back to about in reading your new book, Who is Trixie the Trasher and Other Questions, at your reading, someone asked you, who is Trixie the Trasher? And I thought your answer seemed a little bit reluctant, but it was so fascinating and interesting. I thought maybe I'd just ask.
What did I say?
Well, I think you said you were, it was maybe that you were in a car driving and the name Trixie the Trasher sort of just came to you. And, you know, I had you read this shorter poem for our radio show, but because Trixie the Trasher, I love that particular poem as well in the book, but it's longer and it's extended and it's an extended poem that would be very difficult to any of these poems would be very difficult to excerpt, you know. So can you talk a little bit about, you know, who that the poem in the book, the title poem, Who is Trixie the Trasher, and how the poem and the figures in the poem kind of came to you?
Well, one can only write from who one is, and the person that I was when I started these poems was contemplating being an older woman in this culture and being invisible as a result of being an older woman. Also being an artist in this culture, being a Jew in this culture, being gay in this culture. I had a lot going for my invisibility, and I always resist that and or try to use it, you know, depending on the circumstance. But I find myself there, as Adrienne Rich says, that's the border or the margin. And it's at least from there that there's the perspective that you can see all around because you're on the edge. But on that edge, I made my way through these series of poems, some of them quite long, trying to figure out, in terms of my next identity, who I wanted to be and what I was up against, and not just myself, but speaking for others who found themselves in that same position. Mm-hmm. And so I began to write about this and think about this person, Trixie, who is so outrageous as to be all-powerful. And part of her power is that she can decide on when people die, that she's in charge of death. And I took her through a series of stanzas in which she has power over especially those who are smug or arrogant. And I had to set her forth on her course in the guise of a streetwalker or prostitute so that she would be somewhat intriguing and attractive in the way that we are drawn to and terrified of our own death. We are also, I think, terrified of anything that intimate.
Would you read that poem?
Who is Trixie the Trasher? Is she a faceless woman using a bidet and chamber pot, bending her backside to you, legs splayed, maybe masturbating, naked but for stockings and heels? Somebody who's all over art history and also in dire need of money? Wait a wicked second. Death, dear reader, is the correct answer. A metaphor that darkens and makes more common the young lady in the bathroom, who needs time to freshen up and dab on a bit of face cream and cover her stretch marks and bites. She'd rather go listen to the radio in bed alone, sing off key, and sip whiskey slowly. Trixie, dressed for business as a rare disease, attack of the heart, nerve-blowing stroke, etc., doesn't require your imagination to fuss over her, or a car and driver, or some drunk fuck on the street with a money clip who doesn't know what he's getting into and can't wait. As a writer, by definition, having direct access to you here however briefly. I grant you every little thing is passing faster than he can find his dick in his dark suit. I'm talking about the operator who's been eyeing the poor soul. She's on the street because, frankly, it's time for another Joe to blow. And while he's diddling with his ignorant self, I'm doodling that he's about to die and doesn't realize, because today, death is walking the street in tight jeans. Lousy with feminism, I'm investing her with adamantine fury that she turns big time on you because you're a manifestation, too, of something before willpower or after. That only the idea of mortality, and maybe the work of art, can affect. I've chosen the figure of a denizen who'd as soon read the news as hunker down with anything hotter than a coffee. Eventually, I'd favor nothing more than to get the girl off the avenue. Should I put her in a factory or at the head of a company in something Chanel? Unless you see yourself, you need to stop staring from your plush booth at Trixie, who just spilled her espresso on her inner thigh and cried out, "Holy shit!" Why debase, erase you? I'm assuming everybody has it in her, or him, to dehumanize, so I mash this up and invite a call girl, a synecdoche in fact, who helps me with my hoax poem to fell you like a wall bed. The power I can give her is her dignity, by her gaze and upright gait, distanced from craving, which leads to suffering, which leads to craving, and you paying with the loss of your best self. For my money, she'll be sensible, compassionate, and you won't see her coming to deliver your final blow. I hate to see you suffer. So, hastily, right when people all over this town have their top down, it's a Saturday, could be you're idly reading poetry. Holy crap, you're pinned by Trixie to a stretcher that has never, nor will ever, be thought of as sexy, and whose ancient calling to haul you away is everywhere about as perverse as all the places you've taken this faceless makeup. I sew your handler into tight pants and hope in a moment of enlightenment that you also see her limping and holding her jaw in one hand. She hasn't the time or money to get to a dentist for a root canal or Walgreens for gel pads for her feet. Everything changes the moment we take pity. Her tooth is killing her, giving her her humanity, a provisional victory, and goddammit, it hurts. Would you ever catch her at home, washing her panties before dawn, her dishes, leveling with you in this sexist world of male gaze and female fuckability, everyone looking for a little empathy in the end? What bit can be learned from a culture that objectifies death and sex equally, in an alley or a painting, while a human being, empowered, devoured, tired and crying, too hungry not to hurry after work, drops her hamburgers and fries on the sidewalk? I'm ashamed. Art may be by nature manipulative, exploitative, and fallacious, not ever necessary before food, water, shelter, and a friend. But our most distinguished self isn't simply anyone on the cheap who stereotypes, rather more likely a woman or a man who loves life like nobody's business. You are being made to think on some level scaffolding collapsing that art's a dirty trick, some creep who crashed and trashed your place, or, in this case, your person in this poem. In my farce, my amiable, unfortunate gaffe, a deconstructed model delivers the all-powerful consummation that catches you off guard, bang, with a hammer to your head, a cartoon image, to be sure, perhaps not a gratuity that you can afford. But in your wildest imagination, if art means anything, you realize what is represented there doesn't exist. If there's a murder in a poem, no one calls the civil guard, which means forms are free to lead like lampposts down a city block through perversity and degradation to our higher selves. We get there circuitously. For another thing, Trixie's cracked a tooth bringing the goods to you, so death and beauty are going to need to be redressed. Your own hot, hot grad student in a tight knit, in a dirty corner of your mind, lies beside you in the afterlife of this work, appealing to your common sense. A Trixie the Trasher who queer and straight in some measure desire and post-coital admire for having the balls to make hard, cold cash quickly. I could have made death a god, a razor, a jailer, not the one you are preternaturally drawn to, with the aches in her foot, her mouth, shoulder, her lips all glowy, skin snowy, hair piled to one side, etc. Pay no mind. The metaphor loses capacity after I've had my way with you. Art is cruel, but life is more so. As I lay you outside of time on a cold marble slab as a sculpture of a human seeing and being seen, I tire of the game and lend a tired young lady the money to earn a judgeship and suffer mostly desperate men. As perverse as you, I'm Trixie's brute, but also her witness and subject. Hell, I can only write from my wasted heart that no one gets to possess, Trixie. Fantasy is disastrous. Some young soul's harrowing experience who dresses her body in a little black nothing after a fashion. She's one lonely bitch, you scared shitless in your last minute blurt. If I were, no harm intended, a male writer, could I have you say that? The debasement we all fear the most, hey, death has no personal interest in you, a thing of beauty like a clay pot or a glass bowl. She bows and puts a liquored cigarette out in your mouth. Art is righteous loneliness.
Wow. Okay, so this is, I think, what, now that you've read the poem and we've heard it, and now I'm feeling like maybe it's a question that I have as a writer that I would love to hear you talk about. And I do think that the question that someone asked at your reading, who is Trixie the Trasher? Meaning, how did you create that particular figure in this poem? It is a created figure. Trixie the Trasher is from your own imagination.
Yes.
Solely.
So
it's
for better or worse.
Yes. I mean, so one of the things that's so amazing and impressive about the way this poem moves forward is that there is this narrative sort of sheath that keeps it all together as we're moving forward through these rhetorical questions that offer their, you know, and then the poem offers its own rhetoric and moves through. And then there's suddenly, you know, not from the very first stanza, the speaker as a writer. And so then we are, there's another kind of perspective that's opened up in the poem. And all of these things go forward with the reader in the poem. So now, having heard it again, I really would love to know, as a writer, where does that start? Where does Trixie the Trasher start? And how do you carry that forward into becoming one of the elements, the multitude of elements in this poem? I'm not sure that I asked that question very articulately.
Well, I think all art starts from an emotional seed. I think I said that earlier. For me, it's certainly true. And the other thing that's true for me and many others is that art is autobiographical to some degree, not to every degree, but to enough of a degree that it affects everything we do. And so I am thinking of Trixie, of course, as a character who has power. And then I'm thinking of myself as Trixie, and then thinking of myself as the writer of Trixie. So I have many identities as I'm going through this long poem. The first emotion that I guess it came out of was this feeling of anger and frustration at being outside of whatever mainstream culture is, and then at the same time feeling very powerful to be there. So I began on many fronts, which is why it became a very long poem. I guess I had a lot to run through before it was over. And of course, I'm mostly interested, not in myself, although I'm the agent of the poem more than anything else, I'm interested in the reader. I'm interested in anybody who might be interested in seeing what's happening in art, because it seems like a conversation and more a communion with a reader who is kind enough to read in this busy world. So I feel like the obligation is always toward the other as well as anything I might be exercising or exorcising from myself. So that meeting of the minds drives the poem. I want to say something about not just my life, but life, but in a way that communicates something to an other, who also might be threatened or privileged or underprivileged, lost, found, you know, at various stages of reality.
I want to come back to the idea of the reading of a poem as a communion. I think that's amazing. But before we go there, I wondered if you could speak a little bit about, this is one of those questions, this is the question that was really, I was really wanting to ask, and I've been thinking about it a lot, thinking about your work, and if this was an assignment I was going to give my students, it was like, it would be one of those assignments that I would sort of say, well, would I do this? Would I give myself this assignment? Because I think this is a difficult question to answer. But as you're approaching poems that are political and that have, where you feel like, where you're engaging in political material, how do you personally as a writer navigate it? Because I find this is something that younger writers sometimes struggle, I think, to find their way toward. They feel like they want to write political poetry, but they, you know, there's a balance to be found in the voice.
Yeah, otherwise it's didactic and you're not writing a poem, you're writing a treatise.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly. Or you're sort of just performing your own purity.
And we have that, ethical. We have a place for that in poetry. It's performance poetry where I think that is operative and beautiful, mm-hmm. where one is performing one's self.
Mm-hmm. I was sort of saying, but the danger of sort of performing the self from a point of view that is above all, that is perhaps didactic in sort of saying, in being in, this is the, I am the way of, you know, I'm doing right in the world. And so I just wondered if you could talk a little bit about how you personally approach it and maybe in even thinking about like what you might say to younger poets.
Well, postmodernism's given us permission to include that problem in the work of art. And so one of the ways to, I would advise young writers to deal with their own political identities in a poem is to discuss the problem with dealing with your political identity in a poem. In other words, to reveal all of the awkwardnesses and shortcomings and inhibitions that you have about it. And, you know, you can always cut it later, but I think having some of that in there, exposing the problem, is a gift that postmodernism has given us. And why not feel free to talk about yourself as a writer dealing with these problems? Obviously, that's more difficult in lyric poetry, where you're just writing out a feeling. But as soon as you get into any kind of rhetorical poetry that might be or might not be part of a narrative, you're free to expose yourself and the problem that you're having. And I think poetry has had to expand from simply the lyric capability that it has to include commentary in our age, just because the work of that ever active, ever crazy eye isn't really enough to hold people's attention. I mean, the eye came under tremendous duress even at the end of the 20th century via language poetry, because it had overstepped. You know, I have a headache. My mother beat me with a wooden spoon. I mean, all of these things are not that interesting, really. As soon as the audience isn't feeling what you're feeling, you're not in a work of art anymore. Let's just say if the audience is feeling less, not feeling more or less, not the same thing, but feeling less than you're feeling about anything, that's no good. So poetry really has needed to expand into these other modes, rhetorical modes and even meditative modes that have allowed us to analyze the situation as we go.
Do you think that, and of course you're talking about the I, the letter I,
yes,
E Y E I, the I coming under attack at the end of the century, and I remember that very well. That's kind of when I was coming up in poetry. That was when I started reading poetry in the early, you know, 1990s in college, and was reading, you know, Sharon Olds and these poets. And do you think that though it perhaps did need to find other ways of, you know, poetry needed to find other ways of addressing social issues and stuff, do you think that that attack was more aimed at women writers than at men writers?
Oh, it always is, because whoever is in charge of the critique, and it's typically male publishers, gets to control it. So, yes, unless, you know, there was a way to discount male writers, like, oh, well, Robert Lowell was crazy, so that's a category off to the out of the mainstream, too. Berryman, crazy, suicidal, a drunk, you know, outcasts. Sure, it's easy to categorize. But, you know, they served a tremendously important function in moving poetry along. I mean, if we didn't have the confessionalists, the extremists, we wouldn't have Frank Bidart, who is, of course, a very different kind of poet. But, I mean, we wouldn't have a lot of extraordinary, extraordinary writers.
So talk more about your... what you said earlier. I think it's really fascinating to think of the reading of a poem. I mean, I've heard many ways of describing that, you know, it's a relationship that is, you know, but you use the word communion, and I just would love you to speak more about that, because, of course, for many of us who are, especially maybe those of us who were raised in the Catholic Church and understand I was not raised in the Catholic Church. I don't know why I just said that. I was Catholic adjacent, you know, but I did understand the communion as this moment of metaphor come to life, right? They ring a bell, and that wafer, it's not a symbol anymore. This is something, right, that is now transubstantiated into the body of Christ. So can you just speak
more
about
that? Well, I don't
think
of myself as terribly a spiritual person, but I do think that there are moments in relation to other people, and I don't just mean in art, but there are moments in relation to other people where we move beyond meaning into some more profound feeling of harmony. Might just last an instant. You might feel it in nature. You might feel it in love with an intimate person. But I think it's entirely possible, and maybe it behooves us as artists to communicate to audiences, either live or, you know, people who have taken your work home, in a profound way. And I take that really seriously. And I don't want to come off in my work as simply self-absorbed, which is easy to do because, as I said earlier, well, along with many others who believe this isn't an original idea with me, that art's autobiographical and we're just putting ourselves out there. I think we are part of the experience of a work of art. People who know my work might know this or that about me, that I'm a lesbian, that I was born in New York, that I love Lorca. I mean, you know, they could pick up all of those things. Maybe it's important to them, maybe it's not, but that can't be the whole story, or I have failed to overcome myself.
And for the reader, what does that mean?
I hope it's liberating. I hope that the reader feels a little bit more than just the simple self that he or she or they are locked in. Mm-hmm. That we're somehow in touch. You know, if you make a beautiful image out of nothing and it works for somebody else, I mean, it works for you. That's great. You think you've had this wonderful moment of creation, blah, blah, blah. You know, keep that to yourself because it's a fleeting feeling. It's like being published. You know, it's a great feeling for 10 minutes and then you realize process is all. But if somebody else can feel something from a metaphor, an image, some simile, some narrative, some vignette, I mean, that and is transformed by it in some way, some minor way, it changes everything. A little bit of change, as I said, homeopathically thinking, a little bit of change can change so much. Mm-hmm. I believe language is probably the most powerful thing on earth.
And that notion, too, that when the person, the reader, who is accepting communion, who is also, you have to bring a certain, I mean, if we're going on the...
You have to open your mouth.
Right. And then if we're talking about communion in the actual church, you have to bring faith to it, or it doesn't mean anything. So the reader does have to bring...
Yeah, you're in heady territory now that I'm not fully prepared to understand, but I do think of it as soul to soul. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's what you're talking about. I'm not a believer in a in a god per se, but I do think that there is so much energy that we don't understand in the world. And if language can be harnessed to reach other lonely souls and make us feel briefly responsible together for moving life along in a positive way, then, you know, maybe we can cure the earth of the illnesses that it's is going through right now, for example. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a matter of life and death. It's absolutely urgent to say we are here together, and with these words, we want to make change. But of course, I'm not a politician, and so my way is very, very hidden, subconscious, subliminal.
One of the things that I love to hear poets talk about, and something that I hear from people they love to hear, I love asking poets how they came to poetry. How did you come to poetry? Or how did poetry come to you?
I started writing when I was very young, and my father brought me home a typewriter from the place where he worked. So I thought of myself as quite serious, because not only was I jotting things down, I was typing them, and they seemed important. And it gave me a sense of identity right away. And like most children, I was unhappy and lost, even though I seemed fine. And I was fine, and I'm very fortunate to come from a loving home. But, you know, your psyche is just barely there, and the world is strange. And there I was writing my feelings and trying to figure out, is this a diary? What is this that I'm doing? Slowly, slowly, I began to read from the point of view of someone interested in words, not just to read, to learn the words, but to actually use them myself. And by the time I was a teenager, I realized that I was what was called a writer. Not a good writer, but a writer. And I began to read seriously and in earnest anything that I could get my hands on. So I was pretty well read by the time I got to college. And I kept going from there.
Was that something that your family, that was the norm in your family?
Or? No, not at all. Mm-hmm. Not at all. They encouraged it as a, I think, a hobby, and didn't really approve of it until I became either a published writer. I can't remember exactly when my family began to collect my books, not read them, mind you, but collect them as coffee table items. I mean, I was supported by them in the abstract sense, but not in the particulars. I think the greatest gift that they gave me was they let me be free. Mm-hmm. Even though they had their ideas, in the end, my stubbornness and my determination, I think, won out. Mm-hmm. But already it was there, as it is with most of us, if we are honest with our first impulses.
That reminds me so much of my daughter, who is now about to be 9. And she has that. She has, I don't know that I can remember having it that young, but she has that. She has this sense. Sometimes she'll say, because we're very protective of the screen, you know, screens.
Right.
So she'll say, she'll come and say, can I type on my iPad? I'm having an idea and I want to write it down. And I will say sometimes, just take out your notebook. You have your notebook, write it down.
But somehow it translates differently. That distance allows you to say more, that we now think of as aesthetic distance. It's also physical.
Yes. And just that elevated sense of this is something that I am, it's being made right here
yes,
on the screen.
Yes, there it is in print.
Oh.
One
is,
copy only.
I think Jane Miller just gave my daughter more screen time. Olive doesn't even know.
Oh, gosh.
It. So would you mind, I asked if you would bring in a poem to share with the class. And I'm wondering what you brought in, and if you'd like to share it, and if you want to talk about it and say a couple of words before, or if you want to just read it and then speak about it afterward.
Well, I can say that it's by a Japanese poet, Masaoka Shiki, Shiki, 19th century haiku writer. He actually saved the haiku from oblivion pretty much single-handedly in Japanese culture that was changing and divesting all kinds of things quickly. He adopted the name Shiki, which is in Japanese means cuckoo, because the cuckoo, it is said anyway, sings until it bleeds. And actually, that was Shiki's situation. He suffered from tuberculosis, and he was coughing up blood even as a child. He didn't live until, he didn't get past 35, but he wrote many, many beautiful haiku, and this is one of my favorites. I guess it is my favorite. I'll say it twice because it goes by very quickly. Okay. With a bull on board, a boat crosses the river through the evening rain. Here it is again. With a bull on board, a boat crosses the river through the evening rain. I'm drawn to this because it raises so many questions for me. Well, how big is the bull? I mean, is the bull black and white? Does it have horns? I mean, is this an open boat, like a raft? I mean, is there a human accompanying the bull on the boat? And how wide is the river? Is this like an overnight trip? Is this an hour? Is this, can they see the other side? And what? How hard is it raining through the evening rain? You know, is it a mist? Is it, I have a million ideas about this poem. Is it a downpour? I mean, I think there's some old lady on board and she just dropped her glasses in the river and she can't see. And it's, and where's the bull going? Is this bull going to be sold on the other side? And on it goes. And that is what I love about poetry, that it raises so many questions, has no interest in answering them.
Yeah. That's one of the things I love about your book as well, is that it offers, so often it seems like the approach is by way of a question, which seems like just, it's not a form, but it's a perfect, way of entering into something.
Thank
it
you.
Also is interesting in the haiku that if you were to look at the sentence itself, the subject of the sentence is the boat,
Yes, that's very true.
But
that bull is so compelling.
It really is.
All those B sounds too, and this is a translation. It's Burton Watson's translation.
Yes. Do you know how one could find this poem?
I guess I'd start by looking up Shiki, Shiki, it's translated by Burton Watson. I found it in a book by a French writer named Roland Barthes, who, in a book called Empire of Signs, speaks of visiting Japan without knowing any Japanese, and it's quite a beautiful book.
I love that. Oh, what a great interview. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You can find Jane Miller's poem, May You Always Be the Darling of Fortune, in her collection, Many Junipers, Heartbeats, from Copper Beach Press. And be sure to check out her new book, Who is Trixie the Trasher and Other Questions, out from Copper Canyon Press. This Is Just to Say is produced at KUT Radio in Austin, Texas. I'm Carrie Fountain. Thanks for listening.